Let's start at the beginning. If you can, give me the Cliff Notes version of how the Jitters got their start.
I had a friend from high school, Danny Levy, who was in a band called The Amazing Tools. And they were a great band. They were sort of in the punk era, but they weren't a punk band. They were sort of a new wavy band. You know, they had a bit of aggression to them and so forth. But they called themselves Progressive New Wave. And they were great musicians. And he was the guitar player in the band. And he asked me if I would become the singer when their singer left. So that's how I started working with him. And then when that band broke up, a couple of bands later, he and I decided that we would form our own band. I was working at a recording studio and had free recording time. So he was like, well, we should form a band because you can make, you know, 16 track recordings for free. Mm-hmm. And this was in a time when people didn't have access to that stuff, you know, because it was so long ago. This would be 1981. Right. And so then we started looking for a bass player and a drummer. And we played with our drummer friend from high school, Glenn Martin. And then we found Matthew Greenberg and the Jitters were born. We didn't add keyboards for another four and a half, 5 years. Mm-hmm. But we were a two guitar, bass and drum band and we played around Toronto a lot. And we had a blast.
Now, you guys really earned your stripes. I mean, you did the club scene for years. You went through lots of producers and demos. Now, it must have been really satisfying when you finally broke through.
Yeah, it was. It was satisfying, although the band had changed. For us, it seemed, because we were inside it, it seemed fairly subtle. But we have heard from other people at the time and in the ensuing years. It seemed like a big change to people outside the band because we became more of a pop band and less of a rock band, but mm-hmm. we were a real rock band. Like we, you know, loud guitars and so forth, but we were a rock and roll band. It's funny, you know, other people, I think when they get into music, they might pattern themselves or copy or emulate, you know, the most famous people they can think of or whatever, you know, they want to be Beyonce or they want to be Bruce Springsteen or whatever. We wanted to be Rockpile, the band that, you know, they weren't at the top of the charts by any means, but, you know, Nick Lowe and Dave Edmunds, that was their band. And we, that's what we wanted to be like. But by the time we got our record deal, we were more, without meaning to be, but we were more in Huey Lewis and the News territory than we had been before. And it wasn't really deliberate. It was just sort of a subtle reshaping of the band's sound. And that wasn't so subtle to other people, but it was subtle to us.
Well, it's funny because I I'm going to skip down a few questions here because I had a related question to that, because I've always seen the Jitters as one of those bands, sort of like Blue Rodeo, maybe even Barney Bentall, that, you know, you guys kind of straddle that line between genres and you don't really fit neatly into any one genre. Now, how would you describe the Jitter sound and what musical influences did you bring into the band?
Well, all of us were heavily influenced by the Beatles. And the thing about the Beatles, when you think about their career, they were also straddling genres, really. They defined them, of course, but mm-hmm. you know, they started out as a beat group, you know, and they were playing, I Want to Hold Your Hand and Sara Standing There and so forth. And it was, you know, it was the Four Lovable Mop Tops from Liverpool. But fairly quickly they changed. And then they became, with the album Rubber Soul, they became a band that was sort of, you know, almost folk rock. And then with Revolver, they became a psychedelic band. And then with Sgt. Pepper, even more so. But then introducing orchestras into, you know, their work and so forth. And, you know, by the time Abbey Road happens at the end of their career together, they were something so completely different from what they were when they started. And for us, that was kind of a blueprint, not so much the change, but the freedom to feel like you could be anything, really. I don't know. Remember that movie, The Commitments? At one point early on in the proceedings, before the band has been formed, there's one of the guys from the band is sort of going around trying to recruit people into the band. And he says, and what kind of band will we be? What kind of music will we play? And somebody says, soul. We're going to be a soul band. Well, for us, it didn't work like that. Like, we wrote the songs that we wrote. And then after, we had to figure out, oh, what are these? And I think that would be true for Barney Bentall and for Blue Rodeo, in fact. Although Blue Rodeo were a little more committed to the sort of alt-country kind of thing than than we were committed to any other one thing.
Yeah, it's a very Canadian kind of dynamic of it, is that there's you know, and I can hear it in your guys' music a little bit too, is you just nudging into that country territory, but still staying on the pop rock side, you know. So it's very Canadian.
Oh, yeah, good ears. Yeah, I feel that way too. And we like rootsy music, and you know, without ever like putting a twangy guitar on anything or wearing a cowboy hat or anything like that, but we had some of the same influences. As you know, I mean, Greg and Jim from Blue Rodeo, they were in a pop band before, much more like the Jitters. They were in a band called the Hi-Fis. It was much more in Jitters territory. Not saying that they were influenced by us. I don't know. I think when they were in that band, we didn't exist as a band. Mm-hmm. But we definitely were influenced by some of the same people. So in answer to your question, I was influenced not only by the Beatles, but also the Kinks, the Rolling Stones, but the Kinks a lot because of the intelligent lyrics. And I kind of wanted to bring that to the band. But Danny was influenced by the New York Dolls, by the MC5 and the Iggy and the Stooges and that kind of thing. And Matt Greenberg, very much into the Rolling Stones, Van Morrison, people like that. It was rock stuff, but it was song based, as opposed to, like, none of us were particularly into Pink Floyd, although I gotta say Pink Floyd has some amazing songs, but they're more like arrangements and productions in a way that ours were, you know, more reliably like 3.5 minutes long. You know, you weren't going to get any 7-minute songs from us.
No big Pink Floyd covers in
nothing like that. Yeah.
Now, you guys shot a video for the song Take Me As I Am way back in 84 at a time when videos were just becoming a thing, really. I mean, that song really opened up doors for you guys, didn't it?
It really did. It was shot on an incredibly low budget. We got a grant from an industry group called Video Fact, and it was they would give you some money, and in this case, they gave us $2,500, which, making a video nowadays, you could make a pretty good video with $2,500, but in those days, it had to be on film. So you're actually shooting on film, which is a limited resource, and then you got to get the film developed and color corrected and edited and everything else. It ends up being a big process. So for $2,500, we shot this video on the rooftop of the building where the recording studio that I worked at was at. It was sunrise on a Sunday morning, and we were playing back the song "Take Me As I Am" really, really loud while we mimed to playing to it, and the police came and we're on the roof. So it was our Let It Be moment. You know, all being Beatle fans, we were happy that the cops came.
Well, didn't U2 do the same sort of thing in Los Angeles back in the 80s?
Where the streets have no name. Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, you guys never pressed copies of that song until it was a B-side, like, years later. Why is that?
Because we were stupid.
Fair. Yeah.
We just, it honestly, at that point, the music industry didn't feel very DIY, do it yourself. It didn't feel like you could really do that. Our whole focus was on getting a record deal, and it seemed like with that video, we were going to get a record deal with Capitol Records. Well, we didn't end up getting that deal for another 2.5 years. But it, you know, at that time, that's what it seemed like was going to happen. So rather than press it up ourselves and, you know, schlep around 1,000 copies at a time, we thought, well, we'll get signed and this will be a great sort of, a handshake, a hello to the record industry, which it was. Mm-hmm. But again, things moved slowly at that time, especially with EMI, Capitol Records was a major label, and they moved slowly. I mean, once they signed us, actually, in 1987, they moved pretty quickly then. But I don't know, they were talking to us. We were in negotiations with them for a long time.
Now, you got to talk to me a little bit about this. I read about this photo shoot for the debut album in 87. I understand there were a couple of band members on the cover that weren't really band members. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's totally accurate. So the record deal that we had, it came at a time we're starting to make the record with Paul Gross at Phase One Recording Studio in Scarborough. So starting to make the record with him. Our drummer, David Steinberg, David Quinton, that was his stage name, David Quinton. But he was already in law school at Western University in London. So he was already having trouble, you know, making rehearsals and coming to sessions and stuff. So when Paul Gross wanted to make this record with us, he said, is your drummer even going to be available? And, you know, we didn't think so. And also, Paul wanted to make a different kind of, like, David's drumming at that time was not in fashion in the 80s. Mm-hmm. We loved it, but it wasn't, like, he's a much more fluid player than, like, at that time it was all about drum machines and being very, very accurate and being very, you know, machine-like, really. So given those two things, Paul Gross said to us, look, let's make a record, but I want to use a session drummer. And when we talked to David about it, he was like, well, I'm not happy about that at all. And we were like, yeah, but you're in law school. This is, you know, we've been, you know, working to get a record contract for years. We got to do this. We can't turn it down because of you. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to be fine. And so then we make the record. And again, at this point, Capitol Records is now moving quickly. And they say, we need you to do a photo shoot in 2 weeks with Deborah Samuel. Now, Deborah Samuel shot the cover for Rush's Moving Pictures. And among many other things, she was a renowned photographer, a rock photographer. So we're thrilled to have the session, but we're thinking, okay, we just fired David. So what are we going to do about that? And then the record company says, and by the way, you're going to need to have a keyboard player. And we're like, what? We were together at that point for 5.5 years, never had a keyboard player. We were always a two guitar, bass and drum band. And we were like, but we don't have a keyboard player. And they said, you'll want one for the photo session. And I'm thinking, we're not going to actually have a keyboard player because it's our band. We're not going to add a keyboard player. So the bass player asked his brother, Paul Greenberg, to come. The bass player, Matt Greenberg, asked Paul Greenberg, his brother, to come and appear on in the photo session. Actually, we didn't know it was the album cover at that point. We just thought it was a photo shoot. So then we do the photo shoot. David is there. He's kind of disgruntled. He doesn't want to be there. Paul is there. He doesn't know how to play a musical instrument, but it doesn't matter because it's just a photo shoot. So he's just standing there. And then about a month later, we get the first copies of the album, and there it is on the cover. And we didn't know. So there's a guy on the cover who doesn't play an instrument. And there's a guy on the cover who was mad at everybody else and was fired from the band. Yeah. So, and then to top it off, then they want to do a video, and we still don't have a keyboard player, and we also haven't replaced the drummer yet. So we have a video, and again, David has to come out and play and pretend to play drums in this video. He's not speaking to me. And then Paul Greenberg is pretending to play keyboards. He doesn't play keyboards, so he's sort of hopping up and down behind his keyboard in the video for Last of the Red Hot Fools. Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. Here I am, you know, whatever it is, 40 years later or whatever, and I'm thinking about you know, what it all means and so forth. And I think, and I do wonder about my contemporaries. Like, I wonder about Barney Bantal, and I wonder about Blue Rodeo. If they were faced with a similar situation, what would they have done? Would they have said to the record company, no, screw you, we don't want a keyboard player? You know, and would they have said to the producers, no, screw you, we want to use our drummer? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. And I wonder if I made the wrong decision. I mean, you know, the record sold very respectably and got played. The videos got played, and the music got played on the radio a lot. So I don't know, but we didn't end up having a big career after the first two records that we made. I just don't know how things would have been different.
I don't know. I think that the music is the important part. I think the rest of it, and as a fellow, you know, as a child of the 80s, I mean, the rest of it's just window dressing, like the videos and, you know, the shoots and stuff like that. It's sure, it's nice to see the band, but at the end of the day, in my opinion anyway, it's the music that counts, and that's, you know, top shelf as far as I'm concerned. So yeah.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. You know, and I go back and forth on this. Sometimes I think, oh, I should never have done that, and then other times I think, it was what happened. And really, well, that's the bottom line. It is what happened.
So, it is. You know, And now you can look back on it and laugh about it, because it's really incidental. Is that the word I'm looking for? Like, it's not not pivotal, but now I'm going to probably get hate mail for this living in Calgary, but I've always been a big Oilers fan, and I seem to recall a certain Jitter song, Closer Every Day, being a theme song that was used by the Oilers during their 88 Stanley Cup run. How'd you guys get linked up with that?
I don't know. I actually don't know. I maybe it was through the record company. I don't know. Okay. None of us were hockey fans. I mean, you know, I know that's sacrilegious as Canadians, but none of us followed, like, you know, we followed the playoffs. You know, we knew what was going on and so forth. And, you know, we met Wayne Gretzky, you know, at a couple of different things. And, you know, we had some contact with hockey players here and there. And actually, David Steinberg, who was no longer in the band at that point, he's the biggest hockey fan amongst us. We're still friends, close friends, by the way. We repaired our relationship. But the rest of the band, we weren't really hockey guys, so I don't know how that happened. But yeah, every time they scored a goal, every time they hit the ice, they'd play Closer Every Day. It was back then when I was really paying attention, because you could hear it on the broadcast.
I saw a great write-up on your website, your bio, where you talk about your dad asking you about what kind of music you were making, and after you explained it as not being the to the masses, he called it unpopular pop. Now, so what that says to me is that you much prefer writing music that makes you happy rather than others, and if by coincidence it happens to be successful, so be it. Is that about right?
Yeah, I would say, okay. That is about right. My dad couldn't understand that, because he, you know, if he were doing it, he would have been writing, you know, whatever is going at that moment, you know. And I still like pop music in the definition of, if the definition of pop music is choruses that are, you know, catchy and memorable and you know, music that's hooky and so forth. But I like contemporary pop. I don't write anything that's like Ariana Grande or Beyonce or anything like that. So. You know, I'm not the next Frank Ocean or any of those people. So I'm still doing stuff that I hope is catchy and appealing to people, but it certainly isn't what you hear on pop radio, you know. Well, I just thought it was a good name when he said, oh, so like he's like, even then he was still puzzled. He was like, so it's like unpopular pop? and I thought, yeah, I guess it is. And then I saved that for an album title.
That's great. Now, aside from your time with the Jitters, you've had your hands in a bunch of things since. I mean, solo albums, producer, engineer, composer for TV and films, songwriting teacher, and a weekly radio show, and I'm probably missing a few. So are you the kind of person who simply likes to stay busy, you know, has a lot of interests, or did you just have to find something else to do after the Jitters?
It's a bit of both. After the Jitters, at the end of the Jitters, I had met the woman who was going to be my wife, who I really, really admired. Her name is Arlene Bishop, and she's a fantastic songwriter. And so I sort of threw myself into her career for 10 years. We were together for 17 years total. But for the first 10, before I started making my own solo records, I was writing music for film and TV to make a living, and then my heart and soul were in Arlene Bishop's band and making records for her. And so it was a bit of both. The TV music thing also, I'm really, really fortunate, because the TV thing happened the week that the Jitters broke up. We got dropped from Capitol Records, and we decided we were going to break up. And it was a bit heartbreaking, but also a bit of a relief, because it had kind of gotten to be a bit of a slog at the end. And we were kind of not happy around each other. So the band breaks up, and two weeks later, I got a phone call from a friend who wrote music for TSN. And he said, hey, I want to do a new hockey theme for TSN, or I've been commissioned to do one, and they want it to sound like so-and-so, so-and-so, or the Jitters. And he said to me, well, I don't know so-and-so, but I know the guy from the Jitters, so I'm gonna ask him. So he asked me, and I'd never written a note for TV before, didn't have any idea how to do it, and it's a different world, it's a different art form.
Oh, I bet.
And, you know, writing, like, okay, we need a theme here, 46 seconds long. It's got to rise up at this point. It's got to come down so that the announcer can talk over it for another, you know, 32 seconds. And then it's got to come right back up again and end with a bang, and what they would call a button. And I was like, okay, this friend of mine, Bruce Fowler, he walked me through all that stuff. We ended up writing a ton of stuff for TV and film, particularly TSN, together. That hockey theme ran for 7 years. It was called NHL Tonight.
Right.
And we had Colin Linden playing guitar on it, and it was a hell of a thing. But yeah, so the TV music thing kind of took over my life, as well as Arlene. And then Arlene and I got married and we had a kid, and I got into the jingle business, and which is yet another thing. It's also different from writing for TV and film. So writing a commercial jingle that's 15 seconds long or 30 seconds long is not the same as writing for, you know, a theme song for a TV show. So I was just, one of the things about me that I think is both a good thing and a curse, I should say, is that I tend to say yes. So if somebody says, hey, you want to write a theme for a TV show, I'm like, yes. And even though I may not have thought it through, I'm like, yeah, I want to try that. That interests me. Yes. So I mean, these days I'm mostly occupied with my songwriting workshop, which is called Song Studio. And that's the thing that takes up most of my time, because we're doing our workshop in the summertime. We now do two workshops in the summer and then events throughout the year. And yeah, we try and hook people up with, you know, with really talented mentors, and and, you know, help them write better songs. What I'm working on right now in terms of sort of a theme with my students, I teach at a college here called Seneca College, and I do my workshop, and the sort of theme that runs through what I'm doing is, you know, if you love music, you should be writing songs anyway. If you want to write songs, if this is something that interests you, write songs not with the marketplace in mind, unless that's really what you want to do, but write for yourself in the sense that you write something that makes you happy. You know, that same thing you pointed out about me, I feel like if you're going to do this for the rest of your life, you kind of, you have to love it. And so find the thing you love and learn how to do that, and you know, and write the very best songs you can. And I can also teach you, you know, in certain ways about how to write a song that will connect with more people and maybe make you some money. But the music business, since I began in the business, it's changed so much that I don't really know. I mean, I know how people make money now, but I don't know that if I were 20, I don't know if I'd be getting into it except for the love of music itself. There's a lot of ways to make $1 million that are easier than getting into the music business.
Yeah, I bet. Well, and it's so different now with, you know, downloading and all those things. I mean, it's just, it's a completely different industry, I would imagine, at this point.
It really, really is. Everything is, I mean, there's a few things that are hangovers, but I mean, from the past, but, you know, of the record companies, there used to be, you know, many major labels. And now there are three. And that's it. And you know, there's a bunch of smaller sort of distributed by labels, but they're not, it's not to the same degree that it used to be. I mean, Capitol Records, which was the Beatles label, is gone. EMI is gone. You know, all that stuff is owned and handled by Universal Music now, one of the three major labels.
Finally, over the years, the Jitters have had a few reunion shows, but where are things at as far as, you know, getting back together, writing music, touring, that sort of thing?
Well, mostly what we do now is we just play play once a year, and you know that stopped with COVID. But at this point, we played one show in COVID because it was an outdoor show, and we felt like we could do that. But generally, we haven't done anything lately. I play with David Steinberg; he plays drums with me sometimes, and so I've been playing with him lately. But the other guys, I haven't seen. I saw Matthew Greenberg, the bass player, a little while ago, but I haven't seen Danny Levy in a while. But yeah, we were doing it about once a year. The last show we did, Geddy Lee came to see us play, which is exciting.
Oh,
and we had some real laughs, because for the first time in my life, I had lost my voice so that I couldn't sing. Oof. And so here we had our big night, and I'm playing, and I had caught a cold like a week before, and my voice was just gone. But Geddy came over after, and he said how much he enjoyed it anyway. And he said, I really feel for you, because that's happened to me a million times. I know what that's like. And he said, but you're one funny guy. So I was. I mean, I was able to joke about it and you know, sort of keep it going like that. But that's about it. No plans right now to write new songs, to record anything. I mean, I've got a record almost ready to go, my own. So no Jitters stuff right now, but It's funny though, the new record of mine contains a Jitter song, actually, now that I think of it. One that was on our second record called Heads and Tails.
What's the title of this album, and when's it due in stores, or when's it due online?
The plan right now is, the name of the album is The Impossible Dream, and it's impossible because I'm old. and yet we do it anyway. That's the whole theme of my life right now. Is like, I'm doing it anyway. You know, too bad. You know, you don't like it, too bad. But in terms of in stores and stuff, I like these days the music world's very oriented towards singles. So I'm going to release it one song at a time over the course of, I don't know, 10 months, probably starting in January. I've got to get some videos together first, and I've got to add some final touches to the song Heads and Tails, which is song number one. Mm-hmm. But yeah, probably January.
Well, you know what, Blair, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. I've been a big Jitters fan ever since. Well, I mean, you know, that song in 88 really helped a lot too, being an Oilers fan. And we're going to look forward to hearing some of that new music.
Thank you so much, Todd. It's been great talking to you.